Guess what day it is.
I did not email any classified material to anyone on my email. There is no classified materials. First, let me say that I am confident that I never sent nor received any information that was classified at the time it was sent and received.
There was nothing marked classified on my emails, either sent or received.
From the group of 30,000 emails returned to the State Department in 2014, 110 emails in 52 email chains have been determined by the owning agency to contain classified information at the time they were sent or received.
This is my fight song. Take back my life song.
Ah, yeah. Secretary of State Pinocchio. Good God, woman. Tell the truth about something. 610, we'll give you all the gory details of the FBI's assessment. Came out 10 o'clock yesterday morning when we were getting off the air of Hillary Clinton's nonsense story about her email. Donald Trump suggesting that the FBI is corrupt. By the way, if he were to win the presidency, he'd have to work with Director Comey for years. Good call. So once again, we wake up to a morning of 340 million people in this country, and these two nuts are the two best shots we have. Come on. There is some good news going on in Washington today. You're not going to hear much about it, but I wanted to bring it up to you. There's a Pennsylvania congressman named Tim Murphy, who's actually a licensed doctor. I believe he's a psychologist, who has managed to get forward a Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act. Basically, the deal is with some of these mass shootings that have taken place, you've got a kid or a young person who is of age. They're 21 or older, and the laws vary state to state, but the parents can't get any information on them. And they could be suffering from bipolar disorder or other forms of mental health issues, or even have a more serious disease and be living at home. And the parents and the ones they love can't take care of them or can't get them help because of HIPAA laws. And HIPAA laws weren't designed for that. HIPAA laws were designed for insurance confidentiality. So what Tim Murphy has done, and again, he comes from the side of the business where he understands what the care aspect is craft a law, which is likely to be passed today. But don't let that keep you from shooting a quick note to your representative. And as always, just Google your zip code and say, who's my rep in Congress? And you'll get it back quickly. And just shoot them an email. And just say, please pass the Helping Families and Mental Health Crisis Act. If you're looking for more information on it, and I always encourage you to do your own research, it's Congressman Tim Murphy of Pennsylvania and the Mental Health Crisis Act. Any of those Google search terms will get you to the specific bill. Andy Mazur's in for Dave Ennett today. What's wrong with the Cubs?
No pitching. It's been a problem the last almost two weeks. Bullpen's been terrible, and
they're down to 21 over .500.
Yeah, it's getting to be nervous time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can you feel the nervous energy?
Well, they're no longer the best record in baseball.
No, but you know what? The Golden State Warriors had the best record in the regular season of the
How'd
NBA.
That work out?
That didn't work out real well.
Are you suggesting Kevin Durant join the Cubs?
I would say that Kevin Durant would be a big help. He can cover a lot of ground.
Yeah, he'd be a good tall outfielder. what does Joe Madden need to do? Just be Joe Madden?
Just
not
be Joe
panic?
Madden, yep. And I think yesterday that he kind of orchestrated the entire thing with the home plate umpire Jerry Meals. Yesterday they're down 4-0 early in the game. An awful call at home plate on a 3-0 pitch to David Ross. And Joe came out and got his money's worth and watched the rest of the game from the new clubhouse.
I remember talking to Pinella about it many years ago at a dinner where the science of getting thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
And Pinella went out to the home plate umpires one night and said, which one of you guys going to throw me out? This is before the game even started.
Because I'm getting tossed.
One of you is going to get me tossed. You want me to make a fuss at first or at third or at home? Somebody's throwing me out. Mm-hmm. Who wants to do it?
Yeah, there are managers that will go out and in the course of the argument will basically tell the umpire, please throw me out.
Right.
Because this is what I'm out here for. Throw me out.
Right. So they're yelling.
Right.
And there's not mics to pick them
right.
up.
Right. I mean, everybody in the stadium thinks that they're yelling about something.
Yeah. Will you just throw me out and get this over with?
You made the right call, but I'm out here anyway. Just throw me out.
Right. Part of the charm of baseball. Mm-hmm. Good morning, Sandberg.
Good morning. Joe Madden said that when he was in Florida, one of the umpires that he had a lot of respect for, they were getting into it. And he said, if you say one more word, I'm going to toss you. And he said, I love you. And he tossed him. So
yeah, it's hard not to like Joe Madden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whack job that he is.
Yeah. He's the good whack job.
Yesterday, Brian Campbell was in studio with us. Great to see Soup. The Hawks convention now just a week away.
It's amazing.
And then once Hawks convention hits, it's the fast track to the season. Doesn't mean your summer's over. It just means you can start looking forward to Blackhawks hockey because things start to happen fairly quickly. And yesterday, the Hawks signed a guy in a tutu.
Yeah.
Is that true or is that not true?
It's sort of true. His name is Tutu. I'm not sure if he wears a tutu.
What's his name?
Jordan Tutu.
Jordan Tutu.
Yeah.
Yeah,
J-R-R-D-I-N.
Jordan Tutu. He's got to be late 30s now.
About 30, I think, yeah.
I thought he was older than that.
There's another Tutu that played.
Am I thinking of the other Tutu?
You might be playing about... Or there was a Rutu as well.
No, I knew Rutu, okay. But I thought this was Tutu, and so, I didn't know there was a second Tutu behind the grassy knoll.
Yeah, their cousin 4-4 doesn't play, though.
No. 2-2.
Yeah.
But there was another Tutu in the show.
I believe so, yes. But this
Who's the one that played for the Predators? This guy or the other guy?
I think it was the other guy. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll have to double check on that because I get confused with the Tutus, you know, like you do.
T-double-O.
Right. And now with Andrew Ladd gone, Marcus Kruger, who switched numbers from 16 to 22 last year to accommodate Ladd, has gone back to 16. So, of course, Jordan Tutu has to wear 2-2.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. 2-2 and a 22.
Correct.
Where'd Ladd go?
Ladd signed with the New York Islanders.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which is too bad because we loved having him back.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's the nature of hockey.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, it was going to cost a lot of money, obviously, to keep him around. Something that the Blackhawks did not have under the salary cap as restrictive as it is in the NHL. So it's just one of those things. It's life in the NHL.
Here's what's coming up. Karen Conti on The Law. Patrick Collins will talk about the FBI dissertation on the Hillary Clinton lies. And that's exactly what they were. Got a very interesting guy that we want you to meet today, which there's no reason for me to even pre-plug this, just to tell you at 7:40, drop whatever you're doing and be around your radio. A special appearance by young Kevin Powell today, who's coming in to see my brother is visiting here in studio. Otherwise, Kevin wouldn't get out of bed. And Brian Kenny from the MLB Network on his new book, Ahead of the Curve, Inside the Baseball Revolution. With all your years in the bigs, did you get to know Brian Kenny at all?
You know, I've met him a couple of times.
Nice guy.
He's very, very, very passionate about the new style of baseball. So this book would be I definitely want to grab a copy and read it. But he's very, very passionate.
Now he'll be on the phone. Do you want me to sign up for you from Brian?
Please do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now Mary and everyone and Andre, yeah. This is very important. There is not a second Tutu.
No.
There's only one Tutu.
There's only one Tutu who
and
just turned 3-3.
Oh, he turned 3-3.
Yeah.
Will he wear Tutu?
He should be wearing Tutu.
All right. So Tutu is 3-3.
Correct.
Okay. Got it. And what about Rutu?
Rutu is missing in action.
Okay. All right. So just to get an update, there's only one Jordan Tutu.
Correct.
And he'll be on the Hawks next season.
And we're looking forward to it.
There you go. It's 6:19. We're back after this on 720 WGN.
The Steve Cochran Show.
In looking back at our investigations into the mishandling or removal of classified information, we cannot find a case that would support bringing criminal charges on these facts.
The system is rigged, but we're still happy to be together, right? It's totally rigged.
What? Ugh. Let me start with James Comey. The idea that James Comey rigged the system in some way or is involved in a rigged system is a joke and is offensive. Whether or not he's right about his decision yesterday about Hillary Clinton is certainly up for debate. But James Comey was nominated, or I should say appointed, by a Republican president and is a registered Republican and reaffirmed under Barack Obama. So, you know, it's a situation that just it's just a ridiculous discussion by Trump. All right, so let's go to Hillary, because it turns out she's an even bigger liar than we thought. The FBI's exhaustive investigation into the email mess is laid out by FBI Director James Comey yesterday. I'd like to be running for president and have the FBI director say this.
Although we did not find clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information, there is evidence that they were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information. For example, 7 email chains concern matters that were classified at the top secret special access program at the time they were sent and received. Those chains involve Secretary Clinton both sending emails about those matters and receiving emails about those same matters. There is evidence to support a conclusion that any reasonable person in Secretary Clinton's position or in the position of those with whom she was corresponding about those matters should have known that an unclassified system was no place for that conversation.
So, and to go further on that, these emails that maybe were or were not designated as classified at the time are many. But there are certainly emails, over 100 of them, that were classified that shouldn't have been where they were. Here's more.
In addition to this highly sensitive information, we also found information that was properly classified as secret by the U.S. intelligence community at the time it was discussed on email. That is, excluding any later up-classified emails. None of these emails should have been on any kind of unclassified system, but their presence is especially concerning because all of these emails were housed on unclassified personal servers, not even supported by full-time security staff, like those found at agencies and departments of the United States government, or even with a commercial email service like Gmail.
And when you go out and you travel the world, as the Secretary of State does more than anybody, and you're using a BlackBerry or you're using a mobile device in some way, and you're in foreign countries that are very good at tapping into other people's information, you're going to have problems. How many emails in particular were the most sensitive and the biggest issue? Again, here's that.
From the group of 30,000 emails returned to the State Department in 2014, 110 emails in 52 email chains have been determined by the owning agency to contain classified information at the time they were sent or received. Eight of those chains contained information that was top secret at the time they were sent. 36 of those chains contained secret information at the time. And eight contained confidential information at the time.
So as Jake laid out in the sound he played at the top of the show, in the back and forth between Hillary and Comey, almost everything she said in defense of what she had done with these emails was not true. And how she would think it wouldn't come out only comes back to the same thing, and that is that the Clintons believe the rules don't apply to them, and they're absolutely shocked when in fact they do. So I salute Director Comey for coming out as strong as he did. Now, did he make the right decision in saying we don't recommend charges? Keep in mind, the FBI doesn't prosecute. The FBI investigates. And the FBI has determined, if Comey is the director, that there's nothing here that rises to the level of criminality. Sadly, in this country, and I'm not speaking about Hillary Clinton here, I'm talking about in generalities, stupid and cocky is not a crime. And stupid is what was done here. Cocky is how the Clintons manage their lives above the law, and again, that the rules don't apply. Should that frighten you if you decide to vote for her for president? Yeah, probably. Probably. But then you look at the other side and you go, oh, geez. Really? Honestly? Donald Trump's reaction to all of this was fairly predictable, but he did take on a couple of stances that really are kind of inexcusable. Here's one.
She said today that we may consider the attorney general to go forward. That's like a bribe, isn't it? Isn't that sort of a bribe? I think it's a bribe. How can you say that? It's a bribe! I mean, the attorney general sitting there saying, you know, if I get Hillary off the hook, I'm going to have 4 more years or 8 more years. But if she loses, I'm out of a job. It's a bribe. It's a disgrace. It's a disgrace. She is laughing at the stupidity of our system.
There is not a chance, a snowball's chance in hell, that Loretta Lynch sat down with the Clintons and said, okay, first we're going to go on the airplane and we're going to do it in front of TV cameras, and then you're going to promise me a job, and then I'm going to call the guy at the FBI, and then the guy at the FBI is not going to recommend we prosecute, and all this will go away. If this doesn't fall under how stupid do we look, I don't know what does. So instead of Donald Trump yesterday saying, well, the FBI has spoken here, and this is an embarrassment, and Secretary of State Clinton ought to be ashamed of herself and the way this is handled, but I believe we should listen to the FBI director. I'm disappointed that there's not more that can be done, but I think this says everything you need to know about Secretary of State Clinton's respect for the rules that she and former President Clinton choose not to play by. Not the director of the FBI is criminally inept and has no guidance system in regards to doing the job the proper way, or that Loretta Lynch is taking bribes. He's a fire starter. So Hillary Clinton's a liar and Donald Trump's a liar. And they're both, in their own separate ways, embarrassments. So why would Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton be engaged in this kind of thing? If you wanted to be completely generous, you could say, well, they're older. They don't understand the technology. They don't understand that it's important to have encryption when it comes to all of your digital data. They don't get it. That might work if not for the fact that the State Department is a huge bureaucracy and the Secretary of State has a huge staff that's designed in part to make sure that she doesn't harm herself, her image, or the United States of America. And we know for a fact that there are a lot of people in Hillary Clinton's chain of command who told her knock it off, who told her it was a bad idea, who told her stop using your personal email. And apparently, though many have taken the Fifth in closed-door testimony to Congress and other places, apparently what she said was Colin Powell did it. Other people did it. This is better for me. The more logical explanation of all of this is that Hillary Clinton had personal emails and other things, and she didn't want to deal with two separate email chains. And she wanted the convenience of one. And the incompetence of that and the dangerousness of that is obvious. But the reason the FBI suggested that no charges would be filed is because there is no criminal statute that seems to apply here. Now, we'll take this up later, in part when we talk with Patrick Collins. The main reason we're having Collins on is to talk about Abner Mikva, who passed away yesterday, right?
Right. That's the reason.
But I'm also going to bring up to Collins this gross negligence term that came up yesterday. And is there some criminality to that? But the fact is, based on what Comey said yesterday, the Republicans have plenty to run with. You don't need Hillary Clinton to be charged. You got plenty to run with here. You've got the Democratic candidate for the United States, for the presidency of the United States of America, who has been said, and publicly, the FBI has said, was an absolute embarrassment, and everything she has said about the email chain, almost without exception, was a lie. It's not criminal, but it's certainly bad for somebody running for president. By the way, does that mean I've changed my mind and I'm voting for Donald Trump? No. Oh, absolutely not. Never going to vote for Trump. But I certainly haven't decided to vote for Hillary Clinton. At this point, I may vote for Andy Mazur.
I humbly accept.
6:31, we'll come back with more on 720 WGN. 640, Karen Conti at K Conti Law. What do you call your legal firm? Conti, 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 and Conti? Karen, you with me? Well, segment's off to a slam bang start. Phone's on, it's turned up, we got nothing. All right, stand by. Let's do that. And let me try this one more time. Good morning, Attorney Conti. You've been listening to the Karen Conti legal segment.
You cannot silence me, Steve. I will not. I do not have the right to remain silent. I am going to talk.
I've known you long enough to know that's true. Karen Conti, okay, what's the law firm's name?
The law firm is Conti Law. Just very short, very quick. We don't want a lot of names, mainly because there is not a lot of people there.
And if, in fact, she has to pack it up quickly and move and go into hiding, this makes it more convenient. C-O-N-T-I, by the way. And Sunday nights with Noonan?
That's right, from 8 to 9.
Okay. All right, so let's start with this F. Lee Bailey story and clip that, and then we'll come back and talk about Hillary. Andre asked a pertinent question. How does F. Lee Bailey go bankrupt? Doesn't he have a bunch of money?
Mm-hmm. You know what? He just went into a bunch of – he had a bunch of problems. When he was doing the O.J. Simpson case, he represented a drug smuggler, and he made the mistake of taking into his possession a bunch of stock from a company. The government said, give me the stock, Effley, and he said, no, I spent some of it already on legal fees, and there was a tug of war that ensued, and the government sued him, and then he didn't pay taxes on it, and now with penalties and interest, I think he owes $4 or $5 million. So, you know, here's a guy who is brilliant. Here's a guy who did some very good things in the law, but really lived his life in kind of a sloppy way. And, you know, for most people, living life in a sloppy way is okay. But when you're a lawyer, especially a high-profile lawyer who represents a lot of people that the government doesn't like, you're in the spotlight. And he just, I think he's reached the end of it here. He's been disbarred. He's bankrupt. I think he's 81 years old, and I think his professional life is just about over.
It's kind of like, I don't know F. Lee Bailey, you know, a few interviews here and there, and he was always an interesting guy to talk to. But Having said that, there's a sadness if you're 81 years old and the guy's bankrupt. I feel sort of bad for him.
I agree with that. And there's so much you can do that is good with your law degree, and he's just not able to do it. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, listen, you can't, if you disbar a lawyer, you have to, the world has to be protected from people who are going to steal money, commingle, do things that are unethical. So I understand why the various states have, you know, not allowed him to get his license back. But it is sad because as a lawyer, what else do we know how to do? You know, you're kind of a one-trick pony. And what are you going to do, start driving a cab at age 81? It's just not going to work.
So why was he disbarred?
He was disbarred for this whole idea. He was commingling the money of the drug smuggler. You know, when you take in clients' money and you're holding it, whether it's in an escrow or whether it's because you haven't spent a retainer yet, you have to really keep it separate. And the law is very particular about how you do that. You can't just commingle people's money, because if I have 17 different clients' money in an account, I have to know exactly who's what and to the penny how much it is, because you just can't take your clients' money. That's a real clear rule. And he got sloppy with it.
We'll come back and talk about this Hillary Clinton situation and what gross negligence is or isn't. :48 now. Back to Karen Conti, attorney at law. All right, Karen. So, what is gross negligence, and why can't Hillary Clinton be charged with it?
Well, gross negligence is basically the idea that you are ignoring or have a blatant indifference to your legal duty. Now, you know, those are words that you can fit all kinds of different actions into. Frankly, I don't know what the FBI director said about Hillary's use of the email system, why it doesn't amount to gross negligence or gross, indifference, even what he said. So he goes on and says that she did all of these things and that she was indifferent and that she was careless and reckless, and he used those words. But then when it came down to the charges, he said he couldn't prove it and he couldn't bring the charges. So it's kind of confusing when you listen to him. And I guess it all depends on whether you have your I hate Hillary Clinton glasses on or I like Hillary Clinton glasses on.
Well, it's the people in the middle, though, that matter when it comes to the election, and how are they going to be swayed or not swayed by this. So is gross negligence kind of the equivalent of medical malpractice, or is it not that serious?
No, it's somewhere in between. But when you look at the laws, there are basically two laws that apply, and it's not very interesting to parse them. But if we're really going to look at this, I think you have to. And if you laws basically says that if you knowingly and willfully transmit secret information, then that's a problem. But there, that's kind of an administrative action. It's really not a criminal action. And then the other one, it makes it a crime to remove secret documents, which she sort of didn't do. So on one hand, did she violate an administrative procedure? Yes, she probably did. But because she's not in office anymore, they can't really demote her or fire her. And then as to the crime of removing documents, what she did didn't fall right into that category. So in my view, in the world, if Karen were ruling, would be is we need number one training for all our people. I mean, come on, why aren't our high officials why don't they have specific rules and people who are, you know, following them around and making sure that they're dealing with these rules? And why don't we have, some rules and some laws that specifically say that if you use servers or if you use unsecured email servers, that this is a crime? I mean, make it a crime if we have to.
There needs to be literally digital secret service, you know, now and going forward, who will throw themselves on your phone if you're about to tweet something stupid or send an email on a private server that you shouldn't send, and just protect the country from you.
It'll be a little emoji going,
Exactly. That works. Whatever.
And again, I'm not giving Hillary Clinton any excuses, because she's an extremely intelligent woman and she should know better and she should have known better. But listen, you know, she grew up in an era where I didn't have cell phones and I didn't really understand all those things. And everyone should understand them. And if, God forbid, well, I won't say that, but what if Donald Trump's in office? Do you think, you know, he's going to be aware of all these things? He's going to have some training, too. I mean, it's a frightening, thought of having people who have never been in government before and have never followed these rules or even thought about these rules. So, yeah, training, make it a crime if we have to.
Karen, if they did opt to indict, what could she have been charged with? Obstructing justice, perjury, what charges could she have faced?
You know, there's a couple different laws that she could have been charged with that I talked about, but the one that they usually get people on is the obstruction of justice and the lying to the government. And that's why she was so very careful when she went and spoke with the government, because, you know, you make that one false statement, I didn't do this or I didn't do that, and that is what they rely on. So again, though, look at who the investigator is and look at who is in office. Again, prosecutors have great discretion, as we know. They can prosecute people that they want to or they don't. And given the fact of the political climate, you know, I think that she was not heading for an indictment. I just don't think she was. And she was careful. She lawyered up and she did the right thing as far as defending herself.
So the difference between this and Colin Powell and who else to use private service and government? I guess Karl Rove probably and a couple others is what? It's just the difference is it's Hillary and that we're talking about her because she's running for the White House.
Well, I think Colin Powell, there was a slight difference there. I think it wasn't a personal server. It was some others. You know, there were some slight differences that people have parsed in the media. But again, you're right. It's who's in office and what's going on. And the spotlight has always been on Hillary. I mean, she has had investigations since she was first lady. So, you know, she's in the spotlight, but she has to understand that she is and that anything she's going to do, anything her husband is going to do, is going to be looked at by the people who want to bring her down. And so you've got to be above the law, really.
But there is, and I'll leave you with this, this is an important distinction because, you know, a long time ago, I opened Stupid Camp, you know, where we could put stupid people in camp out in the Dakotas.
We have not inducted anyone or accepted anyone.
No, we've done some
camp
quietly.
For a while.
Yeah, we've done some quietly. But stupid is not a crime. And narcissistic, egomaniacal, psychopathic, delusional, none of those are crimes. So unless it rises to criminal activity, it's not a crime, and prosecutors don't like to prosecute cases they can't win.
That's true. And one step further, I mean, Hillary didn't intend to disclose these secrets to the enemy. I mean, that's not what she was doing. And if anyone was looking for that, they weren't going to find it. But certainly it is of concern to me that we have people like Hillary Clinton who are intelligent and who are well-staffed, who don't know what they're doing when it comes to their emails. I mean, that is just a serious issue and a serious problem. I mean, I still like Hillary Clinton. I still think she's a good person. I still think, you know, she knows what she's doing.
Yeah, but you deal with bad guys all the time, so your standard of good person. I mean, come on.
Well, I deal with you, Steve. I talk to you every Wednesday morning.
I mean, you're friends with me, for crying out loud. So the bottom line is, you have the same sense from a distance that Comey had, that even though this is outrageous behavior, there's nothing criminal here.
Nothing criminal. And was she injured by this? I think she was. I didn't think those words were very kind, and I sense there might be some reluctance with not finding something to charge her with. But again, consider the politics, consider the timing, and consider the fact that we don't have perfect laws that really stop her from doing this or punish her when she doesn't. So there will be laws. You know that Congress is going to turn around and is going to enact some laws that specifically say what you can and cannot do when you work for the government.
Karen Conti, Sunday nights with Noonan. And number at the office?
312-332-7800.
Enjoy your day. Back after this on 720 WGN.
This is the Steve Cochran Show, live from the Allstate Showcase Studio on Chicago's very own
720 WGN.
7:11 in the morning, and Mary's watching the cars all morning. I almost think sometimes in Chicago, and you know, as I've said many times, I've been thrown out of a lot of fine cities. I think some cases more so here than anywhere else. When it rains, people drive as badly as they do when it snows. I don't understand the problem with rain.
I don't either.
It's rain. You're going to be fine. Move forward.
I think people try to go too fast once in a while in the rain, and they start slipping around a little bit. And that's where we get all these jackknife semis.
But where do you slip around?
I don't know. Hydroplaning on the curves.
You can't go fast enough during rush hour to hydroplane.
Well, they don't do it during rush hour. They do it overnight. That's why we had three jackknife tractor trailers this morning right away to start the morning.
I don't get why the regular cars go so slow, though.
You know, there are people that are afraid to drive.
That's
afraid
okay
to drive. But then, if you're really petrified to drive in the middle of any sort of weather, you gotta leave super early, or you've got to find some other mode of transportation because you can't stop the rest of the world.
Or stay in the right lane.
Well, stay in the right lane.
You do need to take it a little bit slower, though, because visibility is reduced.
See, I disagree. I think when you get near trouble, floor it and get out of there as fast as possible.
Yeah.
Rain flying in your face when you can't see.
Book's called White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. Nancy Eisenberg is standing by. Good morning, Nancy. How are you?
Hi. How are you?
Doing fine. Do you agree that if you're driving and it's wet or snowy, you should floor it and get out of there as fast as you can?
No, I like to be cautious when I drive in the
Nancy,
rain.
You're not helping. The book's called White Trash, again, the 400-year untold history of class in America. You know the deal. You got to get two of these because you're careless, you'll lose one. And do we have a class system in America?
Yes, that's the point that I'm trying to make. We like to tell ourselves that at the time of the American Revolution, we broke free of the British class system and that somehow we created an exceptional society. And that one that, in a sense, promoted social mobility. But history tells a different story. Part of what I'm trying to argue is that we didn't escape British ideas of class or British ideas of poverty. And that our class system goes all the way back to the period of colonization. And that's really where the idea of white trash comes from. It's a rural notion, and it was first used by British colonizers to talk about the idle poor, the waste people that they wanted to dump in the New World.
But I grew up around rednecks and good, hardworking blue-collar folks. Didn't agree with a lot of what I heard growing up or some of the actions I saw, but they're just good people. But that didn't stop me from achieving and doing what I wanted to do with my own life, even though people that knew me from when I was a kid say I'm still a redneck. So you move on in a society of free will and the ultimate democracy to do what you do, don't you?
Well, individual examples don't match the statistics. I'll give you a nice statistic. At the time of the American Revolution in Virginia, this is Thomas Jefferson's state, 40% of white men were landless, and land was the most important source of wealth. By the 1930s, 40% of our population, again, were landless tenant farmers, and two-thirds were white, and two-thirds were in the South. So, yes, there are people who can rise up the social ladder, but we can't use the one example to justify a larger social process, because in an agrarian society, it actually undermines social mobility. Commercial societies promote more social mobility. So, again, at the time of the Revolution, Great Britain had more social mobility than we had in the colonies. So part of what I'm trying to point out is that we have to understand the long, long history of where this term white trash came from, the way it gets politicized, and it becomes an important indicator for talking about the poor.
When country music stars call themselves white trash, does it make it worse?
Well, I think it's complicated. I mean, I actually found Dolly Parton's autobiography or her memoir very interesting, because she talked about growing up poor, and one of the themes that she emphasized is that when you're poor, even our definitions of how we define femininity or what it means to be a woman doesn't necessarily apply to the poor. And she felt she wasn't treated like a woman. She, you know, looked forward to a time where she could have all the signs of what it meant to be a woman. So by the time she did become successful, this is why she displays her womanliness in exaggerated form, or as one scholar has called, her excessive womanliness. So I think that I wouldn't say across the board that it causes problems. I do think it's a problem when people appropriate certain terms, call themselves rednecks, call themselves bubbas, when they really don't come from either the working class or from what I'm talking about, the people who are poor and, you know, seriously disadvantaged in our country. I think that that doesn't help. And this is something politicians do all the time. They want to pretend to be the common man. They put on blue jeans. They wear plaid shirts in Iowa. And suddenly they represent the interests of the common people. Well, it's not really accurate. It's not really true. And it's more of an act, a performance.
Yeah, and that is a problem, as is a problem of income inequality and the ability for people to rise up and be able to get square and earn what they're worth and do those things. Politically, when it comes to that argument, even though we're not hearing much of that lately because of all the other white noise from the campaign, how much do you tackle income inequality in the book?
Yeah, it's a really important issue. For example, when we celebrate upward mobility, we have to realize we've had more downward mobility in this country. And I think the other thing we have to realize is that we do not start at the same place in life. So if you were born to a middle-class, upper-middle-class family, you're given a whole series of advantages, the neighborhood you live in, the amenities that are there, schools, hospitals. And what is really remarkable, today we know that middle-class, upper-middle-class parents give almost 50% of their wealth to their children. Whereas in countries such as Sweden and Denmark, because they have more social services, they have more social mobility, and they give between 17 to 25% parents' wealth to their children. So I think one of the things I highlight is how important children are as a measure of not only poverty, but of even the possibility of experiencing social mobility.
All right. So are you optimistic at all?
I don't know. I mean, I think you know how the news cycle works.
Right.
There has been some talk about class because of Bernie Sanders and because of Donald Trump. But whether it will have, you know, stay in the news and people will think about it in a critical way, it's really hard to say.
That's why I trashed the 400-year untold history of class in America. And it might feel like a slap in the face, but, you know, the truth sometimes is what will set you free. Went to see Abigail Gray's World's Greatest Granddaughter, my first grandchild. 6 months old, all the other grandkids should quit. She's that cute. On Saturday, and Lauren and Ross had just opened up, you know, with all the showers and stuff that go on. Abigail's 6 months old now, but they were still opening stuff. So they opened something called Noah's Ark, and it's the coolest thing.
Is it a toy? Like
it's a boat. And it's got tons of animals on it that the kids can play with. All the parts are movable.
How cute is that?
It's really cool. So I was thinking about that, and I'm flipping through doing some show prep last night. Did you know there's a Noah's Ark that's about to open in Kentucky this week?
Really?
A 510-foot-long Noah's Ark attraction built by Christians who say the biblical story really happened, ready to open in Kentucky. They announced it back in 2010. Ken Ham is president of something called Answers in Genesis, the ministry that built the Ark. He said, "I believe it's going to be one of the greatest Christian outreaches of this era in history. The massive Ark, based on the story of Noah, is scheduled to open by Friday. The group invited media and thousands of supporters for a preview Tuesday." I like the fact there was a media preview.
Yeah.
VIP only for
right.
Noah's Ark. People are going to come from all over the world, said Mr. Ham. The Ark will actually open to the public tomorrow, and Ham's group has estimated it will draw 2 million visitors at a time, or over the first year, I should say. The group says the Ark is built on the dimensions in the Bible. What are the dimensions in the Bible? Weren't there cubits and stuff? I mean, who knows what a cubit is? You go into an Ace Hardware, you go, give me 3 cubits and 2x4. I don't know what that is. The group believes that God created everything about 6,000 years ago, man, women, dinosaurs, everything else. So dinosaurs still would have been around at the time of Noah's flood. Boy, that would have, imagine you're in a boat.
And the dinosaurs?
Well, how about the dinosaurs going, hey, 2x2, dude, how about us?
Yeah, T-Rex.
Right?
No room.
An ark opponent.
You're always going to have someone.
an arch opponent who leads an atheist group called the Tri-State Freethinkers. Hey, they had a good basketball team, Andy. Remember those guys?
Undefeated one year.
Said the religious theme park will be unlike any other in the nation because of its rejection of science. Basically, this boat is a church raising scientifically illiterate children and lying to them about science. This, again, goes to my general notion about atheists. What are you so angry about? I mean, honestly, what are you so angry? If all Christians and all people of faith, if all believers are wrong, well, then I guess you win at the end.
Yeah.
We're all going to be underground or we're all going to be in an urn somewhere. So what are you so angry about? Why can't you just let people believe? It turns out there's more of us than there are of you. We're not that angry. You don't want to believe? That's your choice.
Not that angry most of the time.
Now, having said that, I don't see myself going to Kentucky to ride the Ark, but, you know, good for these people for doing it. I don't know.
I'd be concerned about the space, even as big as the Ark would be. It's still an Ark. How do you get millions of people? Because they think they're going to have millions of visitors every year.
Yeah. Well, some will have to get off.
It'd have to be like, yeah, it'd be like the Crown Jewels. Have you ever gone to see those?
Yeah,
it's like
of course,
you take
yeah.
a little people mover and you go past it and then... That's what they should have, a people mover on there.
Is there a charge?
Move people along.
Yeah.
A charge to get on the Ark?
Yeah. Well,
I'm sure there is, yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
You
got to
pay.
Let's see. Ham and the bond, they did a bond offering to build this thing. And the people in the city of Williamstown had raised about $62 million for the project. Now, I don't know how much it's going to cost you to get on.
They'll pass around the collection.
I don't know how long the...
basket.
Yeah, by the way, that was a big mistake when Noah did it. Because, you know, the animals, they didn't carry wallets.
They didn't have any change.
No, just impossible.
I understand that.
But that's opening in Kentucky this week. You may want to add it to your vacation plans. It would be kind of... I wonder if Steve Carell's there. Remember he did the movie?
Oh, yeah.
It was a follow-up to the...
Evan Almighty, right?
Yeah, Evan Almighty. Yeah. That was it. Where he builds the Ark.
Yeah. Didn't see that.
Another one of those movies where they got to the end of the movie and they go, I got no idea how to end this. How about you?
Why'd we make that?
How about a massive flood of D.C. and the Ark flies down the mall and runs into the Capitol building? Who's up for that? Oh, I'm sorry. Spoiler alert. Did I ruin it for somebody?
God, it's only, what, 15 years old?
Anyway, I'll see you in church. It's 728. We're back after this on 720 WGN.
This is the Steve Cochran Show, live from the Allstate Showcase Studio on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
7:39, we were talking about income equality earlier. How about sports equality? How about gender equality in sports? And how about a world-class athlete here in studio? And no, I'm not referring to Andy or me.
Are you sure?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I am. Joining us now is Will Gang. Good morning, Will.
Good morning, Steve.
I got the wrong microphone on. Let's try that one. How are you, sir?
Very good. Yourself?
Nice to see you. Where are you from?
Originally from England, Birmingham.
And were you in or out on Brexit?
In.
You're in. Keep it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you notice everybody quit?
Yeah.
Everybody quit.
Well, we got our own Independence Day now, so that makes us feel better.
Well, other than having a cheesy movie, I'm not sure how that helps. But... so let me talk to you about Girls on the Run, but first let's set up a little bit of your props. You are a long-distance endurance runner.
Yeah, that's right.
What type of runs are we talking about?
Well, ultra running is technically anything over 26.2 miles. So anything longer than a marathon, a 50K, 100K, 100 mile.
Okay, and you run these type of events how often?
A race comes up, what, once every 2 months?
Okay, so 4 or 5, 6 a year.
Yeah.
Okay, and what's the average distance you run?
100 miles.
Oh, my God. I'm thinking of taking 100 steps today.
All at one time?
Yep.
And these 100-mile runs, they take place in weird places, don't they?
Oh, all over the world. From the top of the Rocky Mountains to the Chicago lakefront to Death Valley.
So what's your favorite run you've ever done?
My favorite run was probably the Leadville 100 Mile, which was kind of made famous in the book Born to Run.
Uh-huh.
It's basically a 100-mile run across the Rocky Mountains. So it's all above 10,000 feet, and you have to do it in 30 hours.
The views are spectacular.
Unbelievable.
The setting is unbelievable.
Yeah.
At some point, do you begin hallucinating that you have died and gone to heaven?
Oh, without a doubt. You get crazy hallucinations in runs like that.
So with that lack of oxygen at that height, how do you train?
With difficulty, especially here in Chicago. But at the end of the day, if you spend a lot of time running up a hill on a treadmill, it kind of helps a little bit. You're talking about 20% less oxygen at that level. So you just try and make up for it here by being a little bit fitter.
What was the run where you were involved and you thought shortly, and this may be the worst decision I've ever made?
You know what? As part of the training, I did the Florida Keys 100 in May this year. So okay. It's a 100-mile run from Key Largo to Key West.
And about well, it's all bridges.
Yeah, you go over the 7-mile bridge.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah.
And about mile 66, I thought the world was going to end. It was pretty bad.
About mile 66. Yeah, me too, when I can't pull over at a rest area to pee. Yeah, same thing. So at mile 66, is that the equivalent of the marathon wall that we hear about? You hit it then?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, at the end of the day, although the distances are long, anything over 50 miles still hurts even now. It hurts even more.
Unbelievable. All right, I have a question. So when you run these races, they always say, when you run the marathon, and I interview people, they say, oh, I like it when it's cooler. You don't like it when it's, say, 80. You like it when it's a... Why is that? I would think the warmer weather would be better for you, but is it not?
No. Okay. And the race I was just talking about, the Florida Keys, it was record-breaking humidity. The problem the body faces is that energy is being put towards the cooling systems in the body. So the stomach doesn't want to work anymore. You sweat more, you lose more water, and basically it's like a car running out of oil and petrol, and everything starts to stop.
By the way, Will ran from Birmingham to here.
Yeah. Yesterday.
Yeah, he didn't even take a boat. Andy?
I'm curious, what kind of training regimen goes into this? I mean, I remember running shorter distances and what the training regimen
was. You're talking
was
about your high school cross country?
Well, yeah, I was a great
same thing.
All-conference high school star.
Around the gym.
But what goes in? I mean, how many miles are you running just to get used to this?
Yeah, I mean, it's building up to about 100 miles a week. Last week was the peak ahead of the race that's coming up.
What's the race that's coming up?
So it's the Badwater 135.
Which is one of the main ones, reasons we have you here to talk. Now, before we get to that, the training that he's talking about, have you seen these things, Andy, where they have oxygen masks that actually restrict the oxygen flow to you? Do you believe in those?
I don't use them. They can help a little bit, but it's just horses for courses. I don't use them.
I mean, it seems like it'd be easier to have someone running next to you just punching you in the head while you're running.
you even get some people running with a straw to try and simulate that.
Good Lord, Sandberg.
Can you imagine being his Fitbit buddy? You know, where like if you're challenging, when people are tracking steps, and you see your one friend like. I was thinking though, you could start going to your lake house in Naperville. You could start running in and then running out.
Yeah, right now I do things where I run into a Jewel, run back out, I run into a Walgreens. Will is here to talk about sort of gender equality in sports, to put a thumb up on it, but explain what Echo 37 is.
Yeah, so Echo 37 is website / blog that I founded to promote gender equality. It's my major passion in life. I was raised by a single mom. She raised my three brothers and I, so the seeds were sown early. And the purpose of the website is to highlight the continuing issues with gender equality across all walks of life, in sport, in business, in politics, to explore the reasons why, and then to hopefully suggest some solutions. But that's the purpose of the site.
We'll come back and tell you how you can find out more about it, actually get involved, and how you can inspire. Because one of the things you really focus on here are 8 to 12-year-olds and middle school girls, really, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm working with Girls on the Run, which is a fantastic charity. It's all about the next generation. It's about the next generation of women. It's giving them empowerment, giving them confidence, and helping them believe that they're on a level playing field and they can achieve anything they want in life.
And even though there's something very unfair about being a girl, like I need to tell you three, but it's harder. There's more work that goes into it, and society isn't set up to give you the same sort of shortcuts that we have. And then you fold in the physical differences. That's an issue as well. Sport can give you a lot of confidence to achieve all things in life. So that's part of what you're doing. So anyway, we'll come back. We'll talk more about it in just a second. Will Gaines here, Echo 37 and Girls on the Run. The Badwater Ultra Marathon is coming up, and this is the best example, Will, as you've educated us on how there is equality in sports that exists in the outcome of these races. This is a male-dominated, is it?
No, it's not at all. One of the good things about endurance events is they embrace equality. So Badwater, the overall winner, has been a woman. Back in 2002, Pam Reed, she was a mother of five. She weighed 100 pounds, and she beat the best...
Mother of five, she just ran to get out of the house.
And she beat the best endurance athletes on the planet Earth. And then she came back the next year and won it again. And interestingly, the Florida Keys race that I did this year, Ali Venti, overall winner, set the course record, and she won it last year. And believe it or not, the 50-mile race in the Florida Keys, 9 of the top 10 finishers were women.
Do you see sexism in ultramarathons, or are ultramarathoners more understanding of the equality of the athlete in this regard?
You do get a sense that people are more understanding when you stand next to someone like Pam Reed. You can't help but feel in awe. But you still hear stupid comments. You still hear phrases like run like a girl, and it is meant with malintent.
Pass me like a girl.
Yeah,
win like
absolutely.
A girl.
That's why that commercial, do you remember that commercial? They had all these little girls, and they said, what does it mean to run like a girl?
Oh,
or throw like
spot.
A girl. And they had all these little girls without the stereotypes and the misperceptions and the misogyny. And they were saying, I think it means that you're faster. I think it means that you're great. So
absolutely.
I love the fact that you get them young before all the cynicism sets in.
Where's your passion for this come from? You mentioned your mom, but there had to be something else that drives you as well.
Yeah, it predominantly comes from a mom. When you witness the person you love most in the world struggle to get a job, to feed us, the social stigma of being a woman trying to raise three boys, you also start to see that anything is possible. If she can overcome these overwhelming odds, then anybody can do anything. And I think it fueled a passion to read about endurance, to read about people like Amelia Earhart, to read about these people that have overcome great adversity, and then kind of go and do something about it.
Yeah. Well, good for you. If you want to help, what do people do?
They go to William Gain CrowdRise Girls on the Run. They press donate. They type in a really big number, and they get a nice email.
This would be a cool thing for schools to get on the bandwagon
for.
Classrooms, you know, have young kids' classrooms, elementary schools, hop on and challenge each other and themselves.
So. I totally agree. It's a great idea.
Yeah.
CrowdRise.com, if we go and search William Gain, we could probably find you that way.
Oh, yeah, William Gain. Type in Badwater. It'll come up.
If we go to Echo 37, we can read your blog.
Yeah.
And see your blog. I'm sure it's
Yeah, echo37.com.
Well. You run with a GoPro?
Say again?
Do you run with a GoPro ever? You know, give us the POV?
No.
Just it's hard enough to run 150 miles.
Yeah, I don't want the additional couple of pounds of technology on my head.
Yeah. I think if I ran with a GoPro, I'd have it pointed at me so you could see the weeping.
Be pointing down. Straight
right,
down.
As I'm laying on the ground. Yeah, or pointing up and seeing the clouds. It's great to meet you. You're an impressive guy. Do you have kids?
No, I don't. Yeah. I'm not. You said this at the start. I'm not. I'm a very average. I'm a very average runner.
I'm sorry, dude. You're not.
Yeah, I am.
No, you're really not.
One of the interesting things listening to some of the talk earlier is I came last in the school cross country run. When I went to Grant Park, I did, seriously. When I went to Grant Park recently to help the 5K for Girls on the Run,
sure.
If someone had said to me when I was 10 years old, go and run 3.1 miles, it would have been go away. Not a chance. To see these young girls do this is so impressive. They've got more ability than me, and they're going to go on to do great things.
Right, that's the thing. This is not just about winning races. This is about what you do with the rest of your life.
Absolutely. And one of the good things about Badwater is there's no big trophy for the winner. There's no age group awards. It's not whether we're going to win. It's can I do this? And everybody gets the same medal. It's about creating a level playing field.
Texter said after mile 66 in the Keys race, what happened?
My body didn't like me very much. Everything hurts. There's nausea. Stuff starts to leave the body.
It's like you guys
feel
after 9 o'clock on the show.
Oh, like 8. Yeah. More like 8.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the worst ever hangover times a million.
But you finish the race.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's nobody to pick you up in mile 66.
You have a crew. In a lot of these races, you have a crew, you have a pacer. I mean, with Badwater, it's mandatory. You have to have a support vehicle. You have to have a crew of four that provide medical support, water, fuel, hugs and kisses, and all that kind of stuff.
I've heard stories, and I don't remember, there's another famous book a few years ago, I don't think it's the one you referenced, of a guy who would fall asleep while he was running these ultra marathon races, you know, thumping along. And he, obviously it's not deep sleep, but you would literally, you know, fall into some sort of restive state where you're going step after step, and then also ordering pizza and eating pizza while you're running as well, because you got to replenish, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a book by a guy called Dean Karnazes.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. That's it. You know him?
I've met him. He's a great guy. He's not at Badwater this year, but he has done Badwater, and he has won it. But he's also not finished at points as well.
Well, sure. Now, what do you do about eating and drinking and all of that for replenishing when you're in the middle of it?
So you just try and keep it simple. The standard rule is you've got to try and get about 250 calories in your body every hour. Now, you need more than that, but that's about as much as the body can digest in those conditions. And then you drink like it's going out of fashion. Clearly, water. And you need a lot of salt. The salt is essentially the oil. If you don't put salt in, you can't process water or fuel. So it's basically carbs, water, and salt. And you just keep doing that for however many hours it takes to finish the event.
So you get to like mile 110, 120 for Badwater. You have a Thanksgiving dinner delivered to you?
You know what?
I'll hold the platter.
A keg of beer.
Bacon. I heard you talking about it earlier. Yeah. Loads of sodium. You people eat... That's hamburgers, fantastic. Pizza, bacon, you name it.
He needs the candy. He needs that candy.
I love the idea of running 100 miles and shoving bacon down. Yeah. God, this is a great country.
That's a great plug, though. The ultramarathoners eat bacon.
Unbelievable.
There you go.
Sandberg.
I just wanted to say about Girls on the Run, the thing he's supporting, that there's been this cool change with female-based organizations to help girls. I'm 40, and when I was young, I had a T-shirt that said, whatever... boys can do, I can do better. Uh-huh. But it's still put in your head that the boys are the ones setting the bar,
right?
And that I was trying to get ahead of it. Now these girl-oriented groups don't even they don't even mention the boys. You're just going to be dominant because you're a strong, smart, capable person, and you happen
message.
To be a girl. So it's like shifting, instead of always telling us you have to be better than boys, it always made us seem like we're inferior. Now girls are just like...
Well, and based on what Will just told us, it sounds like women are setting the bar for a lot of these races.
Yeah without a doubt. It's the same in long-distance swimming. The only person ever to swim from Cuba to Florida is Diane Nyad.
And I did it. I just didn't look for the pub.
Did you know? Okay, yeah, fair enough. Yeah. And some scientists have done studies that suggest that the gap in throwing-based activities, because, again, it's technique, not power, will diminish... between men and women in the next few years.
Well, throwing his legs, too. And obviously you need strong legs to run 150 miles. Look, I'm a little partial to the whole dad thing. You're going to be a great dad someday. What are we waiting for?
He's never home. He's always running.
Find the right girl.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be your Jewish mother in this case, because I'm telling you right now, a guy like you needs to be a dad of a daughter. So God bless you, man. You're doing great work.
Thank you very much.
Nice to meet you. 758, again, you search Will Gane, it's G-A-N-E, William Gane, will get you there quickly, G-A-N-E, I should say, William Gane, when you go to crowdrise.com, and you can also go to Echo 37. It can do a lot of good stuff here, but congratulations to all the ladies for Badwater and Badwater 135. Coming up when?
Coming up on July the 18th. Yeah, my wave starts at 9:30 p.m. on Monday, July the 18th.
That's next Monday.
Yeah.
No, 2 weeks.
2 weeks. It's getting close.
Oh, 2 weeks. Well, I may still get in. It's 7:58 back after this on 720 WGN.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Dean Richards joins us from Channel 9.
Citizens of the world.
Some of the world's greatest entertainers are here tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you.
And tonight, guess what? It's going to be Dean.
Yeah, Hollywood. You know I love you more than what I should. Yeah.
812, Dean Richards joins us from Channel 9. Good morning, Dean.
How are you this morning?
Delightful. How are you?
Also delightful.
How's McElroy's hair going over there, the Aaron McElroy short haircut?
Kind of a big hit. You know, we're sort of used to it, so we're not, you know, we're not quite as making a big deal like you are.
There's no protesters outside saying anything in particular?
No. No, if any, it's everything's been very complimentary.
Well,
about
good.
It.
Good.
But, you know, we don't even really notice... you know, I certainly don't hair.
I guess it's funny you say that because I don't know when you reach this point, but in the past couple of years in particular, you know, when I go in to get a buzz cut.
Right.
And, you know, my lame attempt to try to make people think I'm not completely bald. When I go in to get a buzz cut, people don't notice that I got a buzz cut. you know, you don't even get people referencing the fact that you got a haircut.
Yeah, you never. Same thing with me. I never get anyone go, "Oh, you got a haircut."
Oh, you got a haircut.
Haircut to the second.
Yeah, that's great. Good.
See, right. Women want you to notice that, though.
Notice your hair.
Yes.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Guy and you know what? Sandberg, last time I got a buzz cut, Sandberg noticed my hair. Yeah.
I think we all noticed.
Hold on a second. Why are you making a face like that when you go, "We noticed"?
Well, we all notice when you get a haircut because...
I don't think that's true.
You do, but do you want us all to say something? Like,
sure,
hey, you got that haircut.
Absolutely. Well,
those couple of hairs cut.
It's amazing how the ones at the top...
It's amazing how what?
Is somebody getting a haircut?
Yeah, my stylist.
The ones on the top where there's they're a little spaced apart, they get rogue quickly, which I only know because I get, you know, stand next to you. And you're sitting and I'm standing usually when I'm giving you notes.
That's
so
very funny.
Yeah. I'm not like Andrea, though. If I get my hair done, if you don't notice, that means I'm doing a good job of maintaining my hair.
See, I want people to go, "Hey, cool new cut." Yeah.
Because cool then cut. You respond, yeah. "Are you sure it's not too short? You got a whole thing."
But last time I did do that. Yeah, you're right.
When you say something and somebody always responds, "Oh, I'm not really crazy about it."
That's true, too.
I don't know if it works.
See, I feel like when people notice mine, I go, "Yeah, it's the best buzz cut I've had since the last one."
I get in trouble all the time from Annabelle Aval, who sits next to me here in the newsroom.
Wow, she's mean.
When she gets a new haircut or, you know, like something brand new, she gets so mad at me if I don't notice it.
Well, it's because she's secretly in love with you, and when she finally admits it, both of you will be better for it.
Okay, I hadn't thought of it that way.
You know what I think it boils down to is that we spend so much on a haircut and color and highlights and things like that.
I think it boils down to the fact that you're a girl.
No,
that might have some
notice
of it, but when you spend that much money, you want someone to say, "Hey, nice highlights."
I think her point would be that I'm just not very observant.
Annabelle Vaughn?
No, Dean, you are.
She got really mad at me once, and she was coughing up a storm, and I was busy, and I was working, and like kind of, you know, when you work.
Oh, you didn't notice that she needed the Heimlich?
I didn't notice that she was choking, because you kind of learn to tune out noise in a big newsroom like this. There's 100 people shouting and working.
If a co-worker dies, they die. We'll get another one.
I wasn't paying attention. She got so mad at me. It's like, I could have died right here, and you didn't even notice. All right.
Did she curse at you in her native language?
No, she curses in English. Okay. She is bilingual when it comes to that, believe me.
Here's what's coming up. There's a petition drive started to get the actor from Grey's Anatomy fired who went on a Black Lives Matter rant at the BET Awards.
It wouldn't be a big loss for the show. That's all I'm saying.
Really? I thought you liked his deep blue eyes.
I like his blue eyes. I love Grey's Anatomy. Well, I like it still, but I don't think he's a central character.
Kelly Cuoco doesn't seem to understand where the flag should be flown. And by the way, it's not under your dog. And Taste of Chicago news on what's coming up entertainment-wise this week. Some of the stuff Dean and I will attempt to talk to, or about, I should say, and we'll forget in all likelihood.
You'll be calling his name, Dean Richards, the entertainment editor.
820, Dean Richards rejoins us from Channel 9. So Andre and I were talking about this on the air a little while ago. You all right?
I'm okay now.
I just noticed a cough, and I didn't want to leave you like you left Annabelle Aval.
Thank you for asking.
Yes.
Thank you for your concern.
Andre and I were talking about this earlier. Taste of Chicago Entertainment ain't what it used to be.
It definitely is not. You know, it used to be that they would bring in some of the biggest bands that were touring, in the world. One of their stops would be at Taste of Chicago, just as it is Milwaukee Summerfest. They get all the big names to play up at the Marcus Amphitheater at Summerfest. And Chicago just doesn't have it. I mean, Taste of Chicago is, so scaled down just in the number of days that it used to be, what, like 10 days, something like that?
Yeah, it was 10.
And now it's starting today, and it'll end on Sunday. So it's like, half of what it used to be.
Plus, you can't even eat the food. You have to chew it and spit it back into a bucket. They don't even let you have that.
You only get a half of a turkey leg now, a giant turkey leg to walk around in.
No, it has changed significantly, and I don't know that it's better than it has. I mean, this was a signature event every summer.
Yeah, I don't think it's what it used to be, both musically and, I guess the food is about the same. I don't think they have as many booths as they used to have. They have a greater variety of different types of food, I will say that. They have, chef booths now where you can watch some of the top chefs in the world preparing things. You can they have restaurants that come in just for one day and, you know, bring some of their signature
items.
The pop-up deals. And, you know, some of the staples that have been there for years. I mean, you'll be able to get your Eli's cheesecake and your, all your ribs, the Robinson's ribs and deep fried everything. And I believe I haven't looked at the list. I'd be shocked if the giant turkey leg was not there, because that's always been a taste of Chicago staple. But musically, this is what they have kicking things off today. The main stage headliners are The Roots, Jimmy Fallon's band, which is, you know, very cool to see The Roots. but just announced.
You okay?
Yes, I had during that break.
Popcorn.
This is a little tip for you young broadcasters. When you're in a commercial break, it's probably not the best idea in the world to eat like a full thing of cantaloupe, because it'll stick.
That's true. There's a whole list of things you shouldn't eat while you're on the air.
Yeah,
that's one of them.
Very delicious, but I didn't realize I was going to have this coughing effect from the cantaloupe that I just enjoyed.
Remember that one time you had a sugar daddy while you were doing the feature?
Right, yeah, that's right. I stopped. That's why I stopped eating that.
Chase it with a couple of peanuts, Dean.
That's what I need, some peanut brittle. That's really what I need. So The Roots are the main stage act for tonight, but just announced yesterday, Chance the Rapper announced that he's going to be sort of the surprise opening act tonight. So that's a special treat, and Chance the Rapper would make a perfectly satisfying main stage act all on his own. But he's going to be the opening with Donnie Trumpet. The Roots will be the main stage act. For the rest of the week, this is what you have. A South African band called the Congos.
Uh-huh.
They're headlining tomorrow. The Decemberists.
Yeah.
Well, headline on Friday. They all have followings. They all have big followings.
I don't remember the last time I went to see Music at Taste.
It's been a long time.
Was it ABBA?
I actually saw the Go-Go's there years ago.
Yeah, they used to have bands like that all the time.
How about Larry and the Lipitors? Are they there?
I think the last time that I went to a show there is when I was working at the Smooth Jazz Station.
Uh-huh.
And you haven't lived until you've been in 95-degree weather with Kenny G.
It's fantastic.
Smooth jazzing.
You don't think he sweats under that wig, do you?
I don't think that's a wig. I think that may be a real mane.
He couldn't be a nicer guy. Who am I to be a jerk to him?
How
about Ange Ina? Is she playing?
Saturday, Billy Idol is going to be performing
Billy Idol
on the main stage. So that's a good one. But check this out for Sunday.
What year is this?
On Sunday, the Isley Brothers are going to be performing.
Now you're talking.
With Sheila E.
Oh, that's good. The music of my people.
With Sheila E. So Sunday is a pretty solid day. You can go to WGNTV.com/taste. We've got all the information about purchasing tickets and parking and music and all that stuff. Steve and I are going to go see the Congos together. We're
nice.
Put on our dashikis and
yeah, but not the same one. That's when it got weird.
We could. They're very roomy. They're very
the old two-headed dashiki. As a matter of fact, that was a band I was in. Two-headed
dashiki. Yeah.
Steve and Dean and their moo-moos.
Remember that.
Petition drive about the Grey's Anatomy dude, Jesse Williams. This is all related to the BET Awards?
This is related to the BET Awards. The Jesse Williams, a couple of weeks ago, gives that very impassioned speech. It's a speech about civil rights. It's a speech about social rights, about police brutality. It was a Black Lives Matter speech, for which he received a humanitarian award for being outspoken in the Black Lives Matter movement. He's the actor. What's his character name, Andrea, on the show, on Grey's Anatomy?
Doctor.
He's the doctor with the blue
eyes.
It's
April Kepner's husband.
It's Dr. Blue Eyes.
Dr. Blue Eyes.
Yeah.
Jesse Williams. So,
Jackson. Gosh, I can't believe I forgot.
Jackson is his name? That's a weird name.
Jackson Avery.
Jackson.
Dr. Jackson.
Jackson Avery. Jackson.
Dr. Jackson Jackson.
And the fame lady, Debbie, what's her name, plays his mom.
Yeah, sure. Of course she is.
An online petition started on that change.org, calling for his being fired on the show because what they said his remarks were a racist hate speech about law enforcement and about white people that would have never been tolerated if it were a white person saying all that he did about black people. The show's creator, Shonda Rhimes, reacted to the petition by tweeting her support for Williams and said that only one set of rules count on her shows, that rule being hashtag Shondaland rules.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not sure exactly what that means. I'm assuming it means she doesn't care. And a counter petition has now popped up calling for Williams to stay on the show. So I have a feeling we haven't heard the end of all this.
You know what's so weird? I watched the show, and he's really, to me, not a main character. McDreamy was, and he ticked off Shonda, and he's off the show. But I never thought, Dean, that he was that huge of a star, and now he's generating all this pub.
I think he is because of his outspoken words about the Black Lives Matter.
Was he one of the founders with Black Lives Matter?
I don't think so. I think that he
just took the moment.
He just felt that it was a movement that spoke to him.
I got to be honest. I'm too tired to be outraged about a lot of things. You know what I mean? I mean, people can't wait to be outraged about things. Look, he said what he said. You know, you don't agree with it, you don't agree with it. It's fine.
I sort of agree with that. I mean, if it changes the way that you feel about him or the show, then don't watch the show.
Yeah.
If enough people don't watch the show's not going to be around. So,
however, if you don't like Dean on Channel 9 or me here on WGN, still
continue.
You should still listen and watch.
Still continue and watch.
And tell your friends.
Right.
Okay. Kelly Cuoco. Kelly Cuoco.
Dear WGN, those awkward pauses in the morning show.
Well, that's the first time we've worked together.
Really starting to.
Kelly Cuoco, the lovely Kelly Cuoco.
She is
lovely. Delightful Kelly Cuoco. Never met her. She nice?
I've met her one time, and she was as delightful as she is beautiful.
Ah, that's great. So Kelly Cuoco, she took a picture of her doggies. And her doggies, one dog had an American flag bandana.
Yep.
Well, not a bandana, like a kerchief.
How do you feel about dressing up pets?
I think it's ridiculous.
I'm not a
fan. I think the dogs walk around going, seriously, what are you doing?
I'm not a fan
of... You expect me to sniff that dog's butt wearing this thing? It's not going to happen.
How am I going to get to that dog's butt with that shirt on him?
But this particular picture has Kelly Cuoco's dog, beautiful dog, by the way, sitting on an American flag. Now, I don't know what nincompoop thinks it's okay to, A, roll the flag out on the ground like it's a bath mat, and secondarily, let your dog sit on it. Of course she took heat on this.
And apologized profusely yesterday. She said that the whole thing was intended to honor the 4th of July.
By having my dog sit on a flag.
Yeah, not in any way. This is what she said. I live in the public eye. Every mistake that I make, every imperfection becomes amplified. She said, I'm not perfect. She just admits, she did something stupid.
Well, that's fine. So I accept her apology. But if it was Phil from Berwyn who tweeted out the picture, he'd be taking the same heat. I mean, who doesn't know you don't do that?
Yeah, it's not the...
this isn't
really
some
is not
super
the smartest
secret
thing in the world.
Society. Oh, wait, there's a rule on flags and dogs? I didn't know.
Well, especially, I mean, if you're also in the public eye, don't you, stop for a second before you put something on Instagram or Twitter?
Yes.
And think about, are there going to be any repercussions for whatever stupid thing I'm putting on social media today?
Well, she obviously thought it was a cute picture.
Yeah.
Oh, look how cute my dogs are sitting on the American flag.
It wasn't cool, but you know what? Honestly, I think she just didn't know.
But how can you not know? You're a grown-up.
She's young. I don't think she knew.
She's 30 years old.
Okay, she's not that young.
Exactly. Don't we all learn in grade school? You don't put the flag on the ground.
Right.
You don't put the flag on the ground, and then you don't put your dog's butt on the flag that's on the ground.
No, I put the flag away last night because I knew it was going to rain all night and storm all night, right? And as I'm taking the flag down, I'm being very careful to roll it up above shoulder height so the flag doesn't touch the ground. I mean, to some of you, that may seem silly, but that's just respect.
I agree. But I will also say, I mean, I don't want to come down on her so hard when on the 4th of July you're seeing flag halter tops, flag everything.
I'm not a fan of the flag.
The flag being used in
flag golf shorts,
also
which essentially
seem,
is you're sitting in.
Yeah, it seems like really disrespectful way to.
But here's the thing:
the flag.
If you had a red, white, and blue golf shorts, for instance, or shirt, but it's not done in the style of the flag, that's okay, right?
Yeah, that's just red, white, and blue. Yeah.
You know what some of the golf courses do, you guys? They have the flags that are American flags flying in the holes for 4th of July, and many of the courses now will have a little stand where you can set the flag.
So we do it at the beautiful White Eagle Golf Course.
Instead of laying it on the ground, you set it on the little, you know, ledge.
Yeah, we had a caddy that didn't know what it was for and was going to set the flag down. Of course, we threw the caddy in the woods. We don't know what happened to him.
Much more American.
All right, Dean, I think this is one of our best efforts.
This may have been our best segment ever.
By the way, good luck with that choking to death thing. Don't expect Annabelle Duvall to help you.
I'm a dead man today. If I don't see you tomorrow, you'll know what happened.
It's 8:33. Big story next at 720 WGN.
This is the Steve Cochran Show, live from the Allstate Showcase Studio.
WGN Chicago.
720 WGN.
One of the finest attorneys in the city, former U.S. Assistant Attorney Patrick Collins, joins us now, remembering Abner Mikva, who, of course, passed away this week. Hey, good morning, Mr. Collins. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. And condolences, because I know you knew him well.
Yeah, I mean, I did know him well, more professionally than personally, but obviously a guy that had an incredible career and someone for people like me who were on the periphery of politics at the U.S. Attorney's Office and did some cases that touched on patronage-related things. You know, he was a guy that I think anybody on either side of the aisle respected for what he did.
90 years old when he passed, as a former congressman, Illinois legislator, federal appellate judge, advisor to presidents. I mean, he had quite a life, and I never had the pleasure, but it seemed like he was ahead of his time.
He was. I mean, there's this great interchange in 1948 when he goes to a local Democratic ward committeeman and he's looking to assist in the election. And the exchange that he had really is stuff actually that we quoted in two federal trials. He's trying to get a job. He's trying to volunteer basically for an election in 1948. And the Democratic committeeman says, and you can sort of see it in the voice, "Who sent you?" And he says, "Well, nobody sent me." And the guy says, "We don't want nobody. Nobody sent."
How about that for the Chicago system?
Right. And he said, "Well, you know, we ain't got no jobs." And the guy said, and Abner says, "I don't want a job." He says, "Well, we don't want nobody that don't want a job." And then he says, "Where are you from anyway?" And he says, "University of Chicago." And the guy says back, "We don't want nobody from University of Chicago." So it was that exchange is something that we quoted in two trials, a patronage fraud trial and then the Scott Fable trial and George Ryan's right-hand man. But it really sort of capsulized this issue of patronage politics in Chicago versus, you know, wanting to get involved in public service because it was something was the right thing to do.
Do you think because of the way he grew up, because his family was very poor, do you think because of the way he grew up, he knew he couldn't quit when he kept running into walls like that? Because he certainly didn't.
Yeah, and I think that is absolutely the case. That I mean, he was someone who was inspired by public service, and you know, there's a whole generation of folks that were inspired by public service for the right reasons. And I think now we look at politics as sort of a dirty word because of all the messiness of it. But there was a time when, you know, I think people like Ab Nikva thought it was the right thing to do. It was public service, and they would run through walls to try to get into public service.
Patrick, I think everything he did, well, in front of the bar, of course, was amazing, but I love the Mikva challenge. I think it was great that young students would get interested in the law. I think that's a great project, and I hope that continues.
Well, that's, I think, a testament. I have some involvement in the Mikva challenge and have met a lot of the kids there, and they're very they talk about action civics, you know, working at election poll at the polling places on election day and being really involved in protesting and, you know, living democracy. And it's lessons that our, you know, high school students don't get frequently. But the Mikva Challenge, and it's gone national now, it's a very significant program. And perhaps at the end of the day, probably his longest lasting legacy because it's living through these kids that are, you know, learning how to live democracy across the country.
Senator Durbin says, quote, "Abner Mikva was always my North Star for integrity, independence, and progressive values. In an era of cynicism and disappointment, his record of public service was proof the good guys can win without selling their souls." When was the last time you spoke with him?
Well, I hadn't spoken with Ab in a number of years, but he, you know, I had come across him most recently in some of the reform commission stuff after President Quinn appointed me, and he was very, very supportive of our effort and really wanted to sort of talk about being real practical with the reforms that we were going to propose for the state of Illinois after the whole Blagojevich mess. And, I mean, he was a guy that, again, he didn't live in an ivory tower. He was a very, very practical guy. You know, here's a guy who got things done in government, and oftentimes I think people think if you get things done in government, you sort of have to be dirty. And he was a guy who was very high-minded, but he would roll up his sleeve and get things done. And that's the advice I remember him giving me in terms of trying to propose reforms that could get done and could actually, you know, work for the people and not just do something ivory tower that would sound good but ultimately wouldn't be impactful.
One of my favorite things he said, I think it was, if not earlier this year, then late last year, he loved to read books, and he had three daughters and I think six or seven grandchildren. And when he could no longer read books, they said, well, what are you doing? And he said, oh, I'm listening to them on my iPod now.
Well, good for him. Hip.
Yeah.
Yeah, getting it done. We're talking with Patrick Collins, former assistant U.S. attorney. You know, there's this cynicism about politics that you brought up and that we've certainly seen recently goes to the office that you held, goes to what we saw yesterday play out with the FBI and things. I don't understand the upside in any way, shape, or form in the public buying into this questioning of the integrity of people who are giving their lives to public service in the right way. For instance, like Comey at the FBI. I mean, here's a guy who is as bipartisan as it gets, who runs the course of an investigation, states his case, and the results are what they are. It's sad to me, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, I know Steve Comey a little bit. He's impeccable sort of reputation. I can't speak, you know, his 12 years at the U.S. Attorney's Office. What I loved about that office, and I think we'll always love about the office, is that, you know, I worked there for 12 years, and I didn't know the politics of most of my colleagues. There was never discussion about Republican or Democratic politics. It was about sort of doing the right thing, and we were sort of an equal opportunity indictor of politicians. And whether they had an R by their name or D by their name didn't matter. I know that's hard for people who live in this sort of 24/7 political cycle that think everything has a political reason behind it. I know that's hard for folks to understand, but I certainly put Mr. Comey and a number of hundreds of prosecutors across the country and FBI agents into the category of folks that call it like they see it. They make their decisions based on evidence. It doesn't mean that people can agree or disagree with them, but it does mean that they're not motivated by who's the next president. They're motivated by sort of digging and trying to find the facts. And without commenting on the Hillary Clinton decision, I just think that there are a lot of people in the federal law enforcement. I worked with hundreds of them that just call it like they see it. And again, it's not that they always get it right, but it is that they're not motivated by the kinds of things that would bother people on either side of the aisle if they knew that they were taking into account whether they had an R by their name or a D by their name.
Well, and I think one of the strongest testaments to Comey's impartiality, here's a registered Republican appointed by Bush, and when there was an attempt to reauthorize the domestic surveillance program while John Ashcroft was laying in the hospital in an intensive care unit, and the White House counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, and Andrew Card were at the hospital trying to get Ashcroft to sign off on it, Comey heard about it, went to the hospital, and he shut it down. I mean, here's a guy who goes, at that point, said that the best interests of America are not to take advantage of a gravely ill leader at this point. And if this is the right thing to do, we'll figure it out, but we're not going to do it this way. And even in that case, in the days after 9/11, and this was in 2006 or 7, if I remember right, it was a very strong move to make. So the whole questioning of Comey's integrity just drove me up the wall yesterday. And I've never spoken a word to the man.
When you disagree with the decision, sometimes, again, in this political environment, you know, there's the Fox News and the CSNBC, and you see every decision through a political prism. And, you know, sometimes people give, you know, reasons to do that. But and again, as a former federal prosecutor who indicted Democrats and Republicans, and I don't know what I am today, honestly, but I do know that you can make law enforcement decisions based on facts and evidence and not based on the noise of politics. And not that people aren't going to agree or disagree with it, but I do think that can be done. And I certainly think Mr. Comey is the kind of guy who looks at life through facts and evidence and not how is this going to help or hurt a Democrat or Republican.
Yeah, look, people are imperfect. They absolutely are. But if somebody is going to be a judge like Ab Mikva or if somebody's going to be the director of the FBI, like Comey, or a U.S. state's attorney, or U.S. attorney, I should say, I'm going to assume integrity until I'm proven otherwise, because you've gotten to that position through success in your own field. And if that makes me naive, that's what it is, but that's the system we were built on, and certainly I think that's a way to remember Abner Mikva, who was a heck of a judge, wasn't he?
He was a great judge. And again, he was a great politician in the sense of getting things done. And I do think the comment about Mikva Challenge, I mean, I think that is going to be his lasting legacy. And for your listeners who don't know much about it, I mean, and again, I'm not affiliated with it directly, but it's changed a lot of high school students' lives, particularly Hispanic and African-American and kids from socioeconomic disadvantaged communities who really want to plug into to government and politics and public service in the best light and giving them a mechanism to do that.
Yeah, we need more of that, not less. Patrick, thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Patrick Collins, thanks, former assistant U.S. attorney, remembering Abner Mikva, one of his
colleagues,
mentors,
friends, yeah,
if you will, professional inspiration, certainly. And a Chicago legend.
Yeah, and Patrick Fitzgerald and Patrick Collins both, as we know, prosecuted Republicans and Democrats, George Ryan and Rod Blagojevich being among the most notable. And he referenced Scott Faywell, too, who was a Republican and under George Ryan. So very, very fair assessment and very fair attorney.
And that's what you want, kids. That's what you want. You want judges and prosecutors who are going to look at a case and prosecute it based on the facts.
I love his assessment, though, too. Just because you don't like the opinion doesn't make them, you know, this doesn't make Comey, oh, he's a Hillary supporter. He's a Democrat.
Ridiculous.
No, he is looking at this through facts and evidence.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, Trump missed the boat completely because Hillary, the dishonesty of Hillary yesterday should have been what he left it as, mm-hmm, and not to go to the next step and question Comey. But again, that's my friend Trump.
This is the Steve Cochran Show.
Good Lord. He's all that in a bag of chips.
Are you from Tennessee? Because you're the only 10 I see.
Fathers hide your daughters because no woman can resist this stone-cold player.
Are you a parking ticket or something? Because you've got fine written all over you.
Kevin Powell.
You know what's on the menu? Me and you.
The lover man.
Is this not enough?
What's the matter with you? What happened to you?
It's my best work.
What happened to you?
I knew he had changed when there was a packet of sugar on the ground, and he came up to me and he said, Andre, did you lose your name tag?
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Look how sweet this is.
It works every time.
Yeah. If you're interested in Kevin's dating life, Rokan tries to get mileage out of it most afternoons, starting at 3 o'clock. How are you, man?
I'm great. It's good to see you guys in person.
Nice to see you. Thanks for making the effort. Even though I know the reason you came was to see Mickey, my brother Mickey, visiting. He and Kevin are pals.
Not going to lie. That's correct.
All right. So before we go any further, the Cubs are over. Is that your official opinion?
No.
Official opinion of WGN Sports?
No reason to panic. I think Dexter Fowler coming back. They said maybe even by the end of the week, possibly. Correct, Andy, if you
That's
saw
correct,
that as
yeah.
well. But he'll be back after the All-Star break. They're just 4-10 with him out of the lineup. So it goes to show you how important he is at the top of the lineup. Puts Ben Zobrist sort of in a position where he's been needed to bat leadoff. I don't think he's best suited there. But Fowler back in the lineup will help out. And as the trade deadline approaches, I think Jed and Theo will find a way to bring some new bullpen arms and maybe even sort of a flex starter bullpen pitcher, because I don't know how much you can rely on Jason Hamill down the stretch. And even Kyle Hendricks seems to be outperforming his past numbers. But they'll add some arms. I think they'll be just fine in the second half.
What are you hearing about Kevin at Wrigley? The guys in the press box, they talking about?
Yeah, you know, the press box attendant up there, a guy by the name of Keith. He told me there was extra searching of Kevin every time he comes up there.
Yeah, they give me funny looks and frisk me down and everything. It's, I don't know what's going on.
Because he was pat you down.
Yeah, he was
frisking
you
down is something you do on one of your dates.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I think he asked the staff for extra credentials for his dates, which is, you know, not really appropriate.
Well, it's free food,
it's cheap
up there.
Food, yeah,
if you get a cheap dinner, bring them up there, show them around.
Mm-hmm.
As a lifetime White Sox fan, have you had problems being objective?
No, I don't think so. I think I'm harder on the White Sox, to be honest.
Typical.
Well, they've been easier to be hard on this year, considering their play.
After April, yeah. Are they going to catch Cleveland?
I don't think anybody's going to catch. Well, no, I don't think they'll catch Cleveland.
Cleveland's not going to stay 15 over, are they, or whatever?
No, I think they'll regress a little bit in the second half, but the Sox certainly have a shot at the wild card, just two games back of that. That's going to be a tight race in the AL. There's a whole log jam of teams that are still fighting for the wild card spot.
You disagree with anything young Kevin saying?
Not at this point.
Okay. Yeah. All right, fine.
But I am hoping, I heard in your report, Andy, to see an Arrieta Sale.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Matchup in the All-Star game. I think that'd be awesome.
I think it would add a little extra for Chicago.
Just have them both start.
Yeah, but just have them both start and see what see what's what.
Each go a couple innings.
And where are you guys on pitchers in the Home Run Derby?
I think it'd be fun.
See, I'd like to see a one round, 10 swings, and that's it for each of these guys. Just to see, because you know you don't want to go in like the regular Home Run Derby can last for 3 hours if they let it. You know they've changed it with the timing. The
yeah,
results.
But here's the thing: it's our fault.
It is our fault.
It's our fault
because we crave all this
amazing dunks are boring now.
Yeah,
right,
we're exactly.
All guys hitting at 450 feet.
It's all about the attention span. Yeah, and creating new and crazier ways of keeping attention for the baseball fan.
The players were the ones that brought it up,
but
though,
they did.
Madison
yes.
Bumgarner started talking about it. Then Arrieta, of course, wanted in.
Yeah, Noah Syndergaard wants in. He's got a couple.
But you see some of the
year.
Top hitters always dropping out, just like in the slam dunk contest. Bryce Harper there today goes, "Well, I don't want to do it just because I don't want to." That's mm-hmm. what he says. Well, okay,
I would be afraid of them getting hurt though.
A little bit.
It is.
A little bit.
It is an issue. I mean, you talk about the. You know,
I would not.
It's a different
as an
swing.
Owner, I wouldn't let a pitcher take one swing in a home run derby. Not a shot.
Paying a guy $150 million, I think you want to protect him at all costs. You know, just seeing Syndergaard the other day hit a double and he took an awkward slide into second base when the Mets were taking on the Cubs over the weekend, and everybody sort of holds their breath if you're a Mets fan. So
it's funny how value is placed. So, like, Jimmy DeCastro has asked me to walk in front of traffic all the time. So.
Funny, he told me, don't ever do that.
Yeah, well, not for me. Not for me. He finds it amusing. Amuse me, boy. Run in front of a bus.
You'll play a live game of Frogger out there.
All right, if you guys, Kevin, can you stick around? You got something you got to do?
No, I got nothing to do except go get breakfast with Mickey. So.
All right. Before you leave, Brian Kenny will join us in a second from MLB Network. Colleagues with Andy Major, by the way. And we'll talk about his new book, Brian Kenny's new book, and the endorsement that he got from Bob Costas. I don't know anybody more traditional than Bob Costas. Suddenly Costas is all about Moneyball?
Yeah, he's evolving.
Brian Kenny ahead of the curve inside the baseball revolution in a moment. It's coming up on 918. First this on 720 WGN.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
One constant through all the years, Ray, has been baseball. America's rolled by like an army of steamrollers. It's been erased like a blackboard, rebuilt and erased again. But baseball has marked the time. This field, this game, it's a part of our past, Ray. It reminds us of all that once was good, and it could be again.
That, of course, is former White Sox manager Ozzie Guillen. No? I'm being told no again. Three great baseball minds assembled. Look, there he is, Andy Mazur from WGN Radio and MLB.com. Kevin Powell, baseball guru at WGN Radio. And Brian Kenny, author of Ahead of the Curve, Inside the Baseball Revolution from the MLB Network. A book that will bring you to the other side. As a matter of fact, Billy Bean, here's a quote. The whole world is based on utilizing information as quickly and as intelligently as you can. The ones who could do it are the ones that are going to win. And you know why I know this book's great? I'll tell you I know this book's great. First off, it's meaty. That's a book, baby.
Yeah.
Billy, you didn't write yourself a pamphlet here. That's a book. And, by the way, get two copies. You're careless. You'll lose the first one. That's what I'm saying. Welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm well. Yeah, they pay me by the page, so I wrote a lot.
I was pleasantly surprised, and I've missed a memo on this, that Bob Costas has come over to the other side. Bob Costas punched me in the face once over interleague play. And look at Costas now. Costas, and he had to reach up to do it. Costas now, look at Costas coming over.
Oh, sure. You know, Bob said that he was first into sabermetrics before it like even became a thing, because he would argue that Mickey Mantle was better than Willie Mays. Now, in the old days, it seems silly now because you feel like, oh, no, you could look these things up as on base, as slugging. But you couldn't even find, like, before the Baseball Encyclopedia came out in 1969 or 1968, you couldn't even find out, like, how many walks a guy had in a given season. And you needed, like, to put Mickey Mantle's production into the proper context, you need to know how often he walks. And Bob said that that's the first time he was, as soon as he got the encyclopedia, and he said he got beat up for this in the playground, but he would show the kids, look, he walks more than Willie Mays. So, no, he's always been very forward-thinking, and I think now we're morphing from that sabermetric side to anybody who's analyzing baseball, and it's not about the numbers. It's about asking the proper questions.
Yeah, but honestly, Costas is with you now, right? That's the reason you're saying that. Costas is there.
Sure.
No, let
sure.
me tell you something. When I was a kid, I'm 55, and when I was a kid, Strat-O-Matic baseball. Mm-hmm. Strat-O-Matic baseball, the greatest game ever invented. You can have your cute little video games. Strat-O-Matic baseball, give me the dice, give me the cards for Strat-O-Matic baseball. You learn more about baseball and more about math than you would learn until analytics came to be, until Moneyball. Andy, say hi to Brian Kim.
Brian, great to talk to you. Congratulations on the book here. I'm wondering, in your mind, especially with the way that this game is based, not only on the stats, but also, you know, now on money, and how the transformation from the old way of thinking to the new way of thinking is going to affect free agencies, it's going to affect arbitration, and when will that all kind of come together?
Well, I think it's happening now. I think you saw it with on the free agent market. Anybody who's into their 30s now, that the market is tepid. I mean, people are very reticent. Teams are not doling out the big, long contracts, especially for the guys in their 30s. And yet, look, there's going to be a few close calls. John Lester is a classic case. You know, the Red Sox had come out and said, we're not giving long-term contracts to pitchers in their 30s. That, by the way, is an excellent principle to have for your team. But it's going to hurt a little bit. The first 2-3 years of that contract, John Lester might be excellent. Robinson Cano might be excellent for Seattle. Now, he was not that excellent the first 2 years. But when you let these guys go in their 30s, it's going to hurt. But we're seeing, you know, there's the long-term ramifications of these deals. All you have to do is watch the Yankees now to see a team rust out in front of your very eyes. So teams are getting hip to that. And, you know, with the exception of some owners who still like to make a splash, we're going to see fewer and fewer teams jump in for longer-term deals with older players.
Almost every team has very sophisticated analytics now. The Cubs operation's amazing, for instance. And if you're ever privileged enough to see the way they do it, basically it's the Big Bang Theory exploded and landed in a dark room somewhere, and these guys are pumping out numbers. But the numbers have to be analyzed. So the 50 and over GM, I would think, is a dinosaur now.
No, I don't think so. Look, it's about, like, there's a lot of mental math that goes on, and you still have to make decisions involving human beings, and you still have to make a read. I think if you're smart enough, look, how old is Billy Bean now? Is Billy maybe not quite in his 50s? But Billy's an ex-major league player.
Oh, Billy's got to be in his 50s. Look that up, Jake. How old's Billy Bean?
I guess, yeah, no, he probably is. So he's probably in his 50s or just about there. He's an ex-major league player, and yet, you know, he's brilliant. So, you know, it's not about your age. It's how, you know, nimble are you in your thinking? And you still have to make a lot of different decisions involving people. I think you can just make them smarter. And so I don't think, you know, Sandy Alderson was someone who was, you know, looking at this stuff in the 1970s. You know, when he's running the Mets, he had a lot of patience in waiting for this, for these pitchers to emerge. So I don't see it as age. I see it as, you know, how able are you to make a transition and look at your own bias and have various principles in your organization to make good decisions.
And don't you still have to have the Clint Eastwood scout that's out there with the bad eyes who can still has a sense of the feel for the game and marry the two?
No, absolutely. You need scouts. I think the teams that are, you know, I don't have the numbers on this, but I think the teams that are more analytically driven usually have the most scouts out in the field. I would want scouts everywhere. You need, you know, it's just like if you say, hey, well, I want to get this pitcher, or I want to draft this pitcher. Well, I want to see everything that he's doing, his performance on the field. I want to see the data, but I also want to see the guy. I want to see the kid. I want my orthopedic surgeons to see the kid. I want to know the whole picture. Data is a good part of it, but it's, of course, not all of it.
Brian, the audience for your shows on MLB Network is going to be much different from a common fan here in town watching a Cubs game on Channel 9. So isn't it sort of a fine line of giving just the what people are used to and also sort of bringing in some of this new age thinking? How do you do that as a broadcaster? How do you get some of this forward thinking across to the fans?
Well, it's just about using some numbers that they may not have heard of. But even when I was on Baseball Tonight on ESPN, like one of the coordinating producers nicknamed me Sluggo because I was always bringing up slugging percentage. So, you know, 10, 12 years ago, slugging was weird. You know, now you talk on base and slugging all the time, and you can talk OPS. And we know that just means that's just batting average with walks, batting average with power. That's all that is. Now there's a better way of measuring things, and that's you know, the best hitting stat is weighted runs created plus. It seems complicated, but all it is there's a run value to every offensive action, a single, a double play, a home run, a triple, all of that. You get those run values. You put them all together with what the hitter has done, and then you level it out for park effects because the ballpark you play in means a lot, and you come up with that number. It's a complicated way to get to the number, but it makes perfect sense in measuring your hitting. You know, a walk is not as good as a hit. A single is not just like half of a double. A home run is not four times as good as a single. All these things make sense. It comes out with this number. That is the proper way to evaluate someone in a context-neutral setting, not clutch, but context-neutral.
All right, bring me some more lemonade to the porch. I'm about to turn into the old guy here. Brian Kenny, Ahead of the Curve, Inside the Baseball Revolution is the book. This is a game built on tradition. It looks like the same game that was played 100 years ago and longer. The dimensions are essentially the same. The season's only slightly longer. The ball is basically the same. The bats are basically the same. Sure, the roids are better. But in general, it's the same game. And it's a game where grandfathers taught fathers who now fathers teach sons and daughters. When the sons and daughters know more about the statistics than the parents, are you hurting the fan development in the game?
When they know more than the parents? No, that's good. I mean, you want the next generation to have a proper understanding of it. I mean, when I was coming about, I mean, I'm in my 50s, and yet when I was reading this stuff in the 90s, I really thought everybody in the media would just come with me. You know, like, why wouldn't you just start picking up on base and slugging? Why wouldn't you start looking at win probability added now? And it turns out most people my age and in the media did not want to do that. The study in the book actually is why we are so loath to accept new information. I don't like just blast sports writers for being stuck in the mud and ball players for, you know, rejecting information. But I went into why we are this way. And there's a lot of studies involved in why we are hardwired to resist information. But it is true. What you're saying is the new generation growing up on the internet, being able to look up their own sortable stats and do their own all-star vote and say, I know better than Ken Rosenthal. I know better than Brian Kenny. Yeah, those guys are self-taught. Those kids are going to be smarter.
I would just ask you, if you're a 12-year-old, that when you go to the game with your dad, you look at him and you smile and you pretend you're interested when he tells you about RBIs and the fact that the win is still important. Now, if Brian is sitting near you, his head will explode.
Exactly. I would say, look, it's child abuse. You cannot inflict it on your child anymore. You should be pulled away by security.
Andy, Kevin, anything else?
Brian, what's the main stat to look at now? I mean, because, you know, batting average was king when I was growing up and when you were growing up, but what's the main offensive stat to look at now?
Listen, the main thing to look at, and this is important, and it's not to buy it whole and say this is gospel and nothing else matters, but wins above replacement forces you to confront the totality of a player's production. Meaning, we could look at, like, Paul Blair and the years ago and say, see, I'm trying to talk your language.
Great Baltimore Oriole.
Yeah.
Hey, dude, I'm a year older than you. Knock it off.
Come on, Pops. So you would say, or even like Richie Ashburn, who was too old for both of us.
Yeah. Like
Richie Ashburn, who could field, run, he stole bases, he got on base, he had a great on-base percentage, and everybody at the time would be like, yeah, Richie Ashburn, great player. No, he doesn't hit like Willie Mays. Well, yeah, but he's still a great player. And if you use war, like, it forces you to look at guys like Starling Marte, Alex Gordon, and Jason Hayward and players like that, and not just pay lip service to the defense. Because while we're watching the game, guys, we will rave about the defense and we'll rave, hey, you went from first to third, the base running. We'll talk it up big. And then when the game's over, how many home runs and RBIs does he have? No. Wins above replacement puts a number on it, and it says, hey, Alex Gordon is as good as Andrew McCutchen? That can't be. And no, it can be.
Cubs going to last?
The Cubs, oh, yeah, they're deep. They'll bounce back. They're deep. And do they win it all? We don't know. You can lose in a one-week series.
Wait, Mr. Fancy Pants, don't you have a stat for this that you can guarantee the Cubs are going to win?
Listen, there's too much random variance out there. It's a game, and it's a larger dynamic. So, like, there's no shame in saying you can't predict it. There's only shame in saying you are able to predict these things.
Can't believe you're still married. Your wife has to go. Enough with the numbers already.
She says, yeah, could you use that in the checkbook?
Great talking to you. Nice work. I'm a fan.
All right, guys. Thank
See you later.
So much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Kenny, ahead of the curve inside the Baseball Revolution, MLB Network and MLB.com. And Keith Olbermann likes him, and Keith doesn't like anybody.
No, that's true.
So
told you he was passionate.
Yeah, look, I get it. I don't like it, but I get it. We'll come back to the big story next, including very, very fresh words right out of the box from President Obama, making a speech right now on Afghanistan. Stand by for that on 720 WGN.
Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio,
this is the Steve Cochran Show,
720 WGN.
944 live from that Allstate Showcase Studio. And it's like it rain's over. Congratulations to all of us. Cooking Up Change is an annual competition. We got a couple of winners here in the studio. And Emily, are you the boss? You're actually what?
I'm the senior campaign manager with Healthy Schools Campaign.
Okay, the Healthy Schools Campaign is the Cooking Up Change is under that umbrella. And the kids are about to meet. Had to do what?
Well, these students participated in a national competition against 9 other teams. First, these students won the Chicago competition against several other schools. They can talk a little bit more about that. But each team that was sent to D.C. won the competition in their school district. Each student had to obey all the same restrictions. Each team had to follow all the same constraints that food service directors in every school faces every day when designing menus.
But they're making lunches for $1?
Absolutely, yeah, just a little over $1.
What kind of crazy magic is that?
Well, that's one of the challenges. Not only that, but they have to face strict nutritional standards. They face the same time and facility constraints, and each meal has to follow 6 steps or fewer.
They came in second nationally.
Absolutely.
Because obviously the kids from where, California?
Orange County.
Yeah, they cheated. I think that's clear. Marshawn, lean into that microphone for me, bud. And I want you to meet them now. Jaliz Harmon Ponce de Leon. Is that correct?
Yes.
How many times a day does your name get mispronounced?
A couple times.
Every time, right? Yeah. And Marshawn Gibson are here. And the other two cooks who could not be here are?
Nady
Mejia. And Natalie Ruiz.
All right, good. Well, it's nice to see you guys.
Nice to see you, too.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Marshawn, you and I were just talking off the air. One of the things Marshawn and I are bonding over is we have the same hair. so we're talking
he's
about
got really
that.
Cool hair.
Yeah, and I don't have any.
Just lacking a little.
You're going to chef. You're going off to college. You hope to be a chef.
Yes.
All right. So where's your interest in food come from?
My interest in food comes from it's kind of a long family thing because all my family, actually everyone in the world has to eat. But
yeah, that's a good point.
But my family just loves to eat. That's kind of where everyone gets along and get their bonding from.
But you have a mom or a grandmom or a pops that cooks.
My mom tends to cook a lot. My grandmother used to do a lot of dessert and pastries, but that's not really my area.
Sure. Yeah. So did you just pay attention? Or?
Yeah, I was always in the kitchen and around.
How about you, Jaliz?
It comes from my grandpa.
Get that mic right in front if you don't mind. There you go.
I cook with my grandpa ever since I was little because my mom would always be working, and okay. My grandpa would always cook for me, so I would always cook with him. And then I started off putting eggs in the microwave was how I would cook.
Right, and you went eggs in a microwave. I bet I can do even more. So you guys got interested in this competition. You end up finishing second. What do you get for second place? Lunch? What do you get?
For second place, first place gets 3 knives, 3 chef knives.
Yeah, they cheated.
Pots and pans. And then second place, we just get 2 chef's knives, and third place gets 1 chef knife.
Those are nice knives, though.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you can use those for.
Right. Yeah.
And an all expenses paid trip to D.C. and a trophy. Oh yeah.
Forgot that part.
Did you guys have a chance to look around, see some of the tourist stuff?
Yeah, we did. Yes. It was really nice.
Pretty great, right?
Yeah, it was very hot. It was actually a big thing for me because I've never ever been to D.C. I always just seen it on TV.
Isn't it cool?
Yeah,
it's inspirational.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes you want to be a part of it. Makes you feel good to be an American.
Yeah, and they got to meet with Senator Durbin and talk about the Child Nutrition Act that's up for reauthorization.
Yes.
And meet with Senator Kirkstaff as well.
And how are we doing on that bill?
It's currently up for debate in the House, and Healthy Schools Campaign definitely is still advocating for strong nutritional standards. And these students show that not only can you, like, they can make a meal with the same budget constraints and nutritional restraints that their peers will enjoy.
Cajun chicken lettuce wrap, roasted corn relish, deconstructed peach and yogurt pizza. This is what you guys made?
Yes.
Same thing you have every day, I know. So how did you come up with that? Were you given a recipe?
No, actually it wasn't. It was kind of just like we had a packet with all the nutritions and all the different things we can use and everything that's in our lunchroom kitchens. And it was like kind of...
So you had to come up with the idea?
Yeah.
What is a deconstructed peach? A peach with a self-esteem problem?
No, it's a deconstructed peach and yogurt pizza.
Ah, okay. So that was one of the ingredients.
Yeah, it was peaches, yogurt, and pizza crust, and parboiled pizza crust.
See, that sounds good.
It does.
It's like
good.
A dessert pizza.
Yes.
So how do you guys decide between four cooks what you're going to make?
It was actually distributed upon us, like main dish, side dish, and fruit dish.
Okay, but then you had to get it done.
Yeah.
Were you happy with the results? I mean, obviously, second place is pretty great, but once you do you get a chance to taste it before the judges do?
Yes.
So was that good, or were you too close to it to understand if it was good or not?
I'll say it was too much.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I mean, don't get me wrong. It's always good to eat your own food and taste it, and it's being good. But
right.
You know, but eating it over and over again, you're just like, okay.
Now right, I'm done.
Yeah.
Celebrity chef judges were there as well. You guys watch food TV much?
Yes.
You're kind of addicted?
Yeah, because I get all my ideas from there. That's where I get most of my ideas from.
Do you guys like the shows where, like Chopped, where they give you four crazy ingredients and you have to make a meal? You like those?
We did that actually. Marshawn at our school. We put like Marshawn and one of our friends Tim's like up for Chopped, and they both were like all stressed out.
What were the ingredients?
What was it? Chicken,
romaine, lettuce.
No, it was cabbage.
It was cabbage. Yep.
You don't remember. I remember.
It was cabbage because you still have the twitch. I can still smell it today.
It was cabbage, peppers, green and red. It was rice, and that was it. You only had like three, and then they could choose like spices that they wanted to add.
I think it's great that you guys are doing this. On top of the fact that, you know, knowing how to cook healthy is a great idea, but to be able to do this and turn it into what you want to do in college is pretty great because, as you know, most people your age have no idea what they want to do with your life. So to have this kind of focus is very cool.
Yeah.
Good for both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, big family support, I hope?
Yes.
Everybody behind you? Good. Well, they ought to be proud. Emily, tell me more about the program. I mean, does every school get involved in this, or is it sort of a voluntary thing?
Every school in Chicago is welcome to participate in the Chicago contest. Do you two remember how many schools you participated against?
In nationals?
Chicago? In Chicago.
In Chicago, was 18.
Yeah,
said?
I think it was 18. I think it was 18
schools total.
So we're kind of just scratching the surface, right? I mean, we need more participation from schools, I would think.
Absolutely. Well, I hope more students enter next year's Cooking Up Change contest in Chicago. It should be taking place this fall. And these two students are from George Washington High School. There are winners this year. But yeah, certainly we invite more schools to get involved.
So if you were a parent or a guardian of a CPS kid and have any interest in this at all, ask your school and ask them to ask the school to get involved and get it done.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really important opportunity, not only for these students, but also to put student voices at the front and center of the national conversation around school food.
Sure. All right, so I want to ask each of you, if money was no object, you can use any ingredient that you want, what would each of your ideal meals be if you could make it for yourself or your family?
And Marshawn, I know you, dude. You're an 18-year-old guy. You're going to make it for you, and you're going to eat it.
Yeah, steaks. No.
Yeah, I was going to say steak.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I was going to say like between steak or gumbo. That was the
steak
last
or gumbo.
Oh, gumbo. Oh, yeah. That's hard to make.
Yeah.
Gumbo.
I don't even I'm gonna be honest. I didn't really think so. I mean, once you, because I mean, we've, I mean, if you learn how to read a recipe, you'll be surprised of how easy it is. It's kind of just.
You got a special thing you're really good at, like a go-to recipe that you love to make?
So far, I guess you could say it's gumbo.
It's gumbo?
Yeah.
I didn't know gumbo was. My mother would tell you gumbo's not easy, and she's a great cook. What about you, Jalees?
Pasta.
Pasta. Yeah, hot water, baby. It's a specialty of mine. All right, real quickly before we run out of time, Mary Vandeveld, worst school lunch you ever had? Because we come from an era known as the 70s and 80s. And in the 70s and 80s, the food they fed us would be illegal now. Mary?
Oh, I don't know. Our pizza was really bad.
Yeah, kind of like a shoe, like a shoe with tomato sauce.
It was awful.
Yeah. Plus, you got tater tots with everything.
Oh, I didn't like the tots. A lot of kids love the tots.
I still love the tots.
I love the tots.
Yeah, I love the tots. Andy?
We had some kind of a mystery meat casserole one day. Ooh. I don't know what the meat actually was. I don't know where they found it or where they got it, but it was what we had.
Did they compress it into some sort of geometric shape?
Yeah, I think it was in, it was like meatballs.
Brick form?
It was almost
meatballs.
Like meatballs, yeah, but it was not fantastic. A meatball. Trust me, I remember that.
Sam?
No, mine, remember this? Salisbury steak.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But maybe that's what the meat was.
It wasn't Salisbury steak. It wasn't a steak like Marshawn is going to make me.
Yeah.
I already have making me a steak and some gumbo.
Yeah, actually, I'm a little older than you guys. In the 70s, we just had water. Food hadn't been invented.
Remember when milk was a quarter? Sorry, guys.
Well, I'm proud of you guys. Congratulations. Thank and I you. Wish you nothing but success. And you're going off to school, and you're going to crush it.
Yeah.
Going to be great. Jalees Harmon, Ponce de Leon, and Marshawn Gibson, both from Washington High School, second nationally because the first place team cheated, in the National Healthy Cooking Competition, all part of what Chicago schools are trying to do and do better and cooking up change. And Emily, thanks for coming over.
Thank you for having us.
You got a website you want to send parents to or anybody for encouragement?
Absolutely. Please go to healthyschoolscampaign.org. And if they want to learn more about cooking up change, it's right there on the website.
All right. Thanks. Nice job by you as well. We'll come back with the Bill and Wendy Show in a moment on 720 WGN.